Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we travel to South Africa to see how the other guy lives. We will introduce you to a man who has some new ideas about living in the big city. Our second item is for the birds. Actually, it's about the birds and how they have known something for thousands of years that we are just learning. As It Is, a radio and internet program to help you learn and improve your American English, is coming your way from VOA. Ten years ago, the central downtown business area of Johannesburg, South Africa, looked as if it had seen much better days. Many buildings stood empty. Normal city services had stopped operating. But these days, in the area known as CDB, things are different. Anderson Street is a main connector in downtown Johannesburg. Very near that street, Dirk Baumann walks through a building's entrance area. He steps into the elevator and rides up to the fourth level. He opens a door at the end of the hall and enters a space planned for both work and home living. The area has become his personal design and building project since he bought the apartment 6 years ago. Mr. Baumann is an architect and artist who grew up in the suburbs north of Johannesburg. But he says urban living connects him better to the community than living in towns on the edges of cities.
For me, living in the city, what was a means to kind of connect with people in a kind of everyday, ordinary way without sort of having to be pretentious or, and feel that you feel part and belong to something.
Over the last few years, developers have retaken ownership of many buildings. Crime has decreased. Middle and upper-class home buyers have started to take an interest in the area. Mr. Baumann designed and built his own modern apartment. It is both home and office. It uses movable furniture to make the space seem as large as possible. But he says there is one problem with living in the city.
The only thing that I miss is getting a full night's sleep. I'm very sensitive to noise, and so I always wake up when someone's walking down the road and shouting, or the people, they hoot when they want to get into the building.
He says except for the lack of sleep, the area provides easy living. He can buy food, eat at restaurants, and get all his art materials within minutes from home. Just outside the downtown area is Johannesburg's Brixton neighborhood. Small houses there are built close to the ground. Homeless people often sleep on steps and porches and under building extensions that protect them from the rain and the hot sun. Some people see danger in Brixton, but architect Thomas Chapman sees something else. He says he sees the possibility of apartment living, or what is called loft living. Mr. Chapman says the area has great promise to develop and increase its population.
That's why we're choosing to act here, because I don't think it's been fully realized, the potential here for what we call loft living or apartment living.
Mr. Chapman is with a group called Local Studio. He and his partners are working on a building with 8 apartment units, a coffee shop, and a new office space for their own businesses. Mr. Chapman says developers are leading the efforts to redevelop CDB, but he says the city attracted their interest. He said, for example, the city invested in such community basics as pavement, hard roads, and sidewalks.
The truth is that management has gotten better, and crime has gotten less. I strongly believe it's an urban management issue, and the city has made strides.
Still, developers are taking private responsibility for some issues. Mr. Chapman pointed to the successful development of Mabinang. Developers there have hired full-time security guards. They also have invested in street lighting and waste management. Mr. Chapman says his development will likely need some of those same investments. And he says they usually provide a return. The architect says there is a great chance for Johannesburg's city neighborhoods to grow and compete with traditional living in the suburbs. He says that as a designer of cities, he believes that is where the future lies. No matter where people are making new homes and offices, saving energy is important. For us humans, the goal can be difficult. But for some of our feathered friends, being energy efficient comes naturally. Just take a look up there. Scientists at Britain's Royal Veterinary College in London may have solved a mystery that has puzzled us for years. Why do flocks of birds often fly in a formation that looks similar to the letter V? The answer is, they say, because it saves energy. This is how it works. Many drivers know that being behind a large truck can save you gasoline. That is because the truck is pushing a lot of air around it. The car faces less resistance because a partial vacuum, an empty space, is created behind it. Stephen Portugal, a researcher at the Royal Veterinary College, says birds knew that long ago. The scientific team studied northern bald ibises. They placed small devices on the back of each bird. One of the devices, a kind of GPS, recorded the flight plan it followed. The other device documented the bird's wing movements. The reading showed that the birds could use the rising stream of air created by the tip, the edge of the wing, of the bird flying in front of it. Mr. Portugal said it was already known from earlier research that birds could be helped to save their energy by flying in V formation, but he said his team showed the way the upward stream of air could be put to work.
Scientists have predicted that birds could take advantage of this by flying in a V formation shape. But actually what no one had been able to do previously was to understand the mechanism by which that upwash could be captured.
The Austrian conservation group, Waldorup team, and its special aircraft helped the British scientists. With that help, they were able to follow the birds on their migration to Italy. The GPS navigation devices recorded in real time the position and speed of each bird within the flock. The other devices, the accelerometers, recorded how fast and hard each bird flapped its wings back and forth. The scientists recreated the birds' movements in a computer. Jim Usherwood is a Royal Veterinary College professor. He says each bird was very effective in reacting and responding to the movement of the bird just in front of it.
If you can position yourself in the right bit of upwards air, then you can get some kind of benefit.
Scientists now plan to study how the birds decide which bird will lead the flock on yearly migrations across Europe. My, how time flies when you are having fun. Get it? Flies? Birds? Oh well. Thank you for spending some time with us. Remember, more Learning English programs are just seconds away, and world news follows at the beginning of the hour. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We'll see you later.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Recently, there have been efforts to make sure children in Africa get a good, strong education. But a new report says governments are losing about $129 billion every year on poor quality education. As a result, about one in four students in poor countries cannot read a complete sentence. That represents about 175 million young people. The report comes from UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. It says poor teacher training and spending cuts are just two of the reasons for underperforming school systems. Pauline Rose, an education specialist, directed the report. She says more teachers are needed across Africa, especially in countries south of the Sahara Desert. She says the area would need about 225,000 additional teachers a year to guarantee a primary school education for all boys and girls by 2015. Ms. Rose says governments like to save money by using contract teachers. These educators are not government employees, but work under a special agreement. Contract teachers can be easily dismissed if found to be underperforming. They also earn far less money than teachers working for the government. Contract teachers represent more than half of the teaching workforce in many West African countries. Pauline Rose says teachers need to have a strong desire to help children learn. She says they should want to be in the classroom instead of doing other jobs. In recent years, financial support for education has gone down or stayed the same in many countries. The UNESCO report says governments will need to increase spending on education. Ms. Rose says governments can do better at collecting taxes and making sure everyone pays their fair share of taxes. She says governments could also offer good housing to make sure impoverished areas have enough teachers. The report says South Africa gives 6 times more money to students in areas with low education levels and high unemployment. Malawi is creating teacher colleges to train new candidates for teaching positions in skills for rural areas. And Ethiopia is urging mentors and supervisors to help support teaching candidates. And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. John Quincy Adams was sworn in as President of the United States on March 4, 1825. A big crowd came to the Capitol building for the ceremony. All the leaders of government were there, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court justices, and James Monroe. Monroe's two terms as president were ending. President-elect Adams focused his inaugural address on unity. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that during the past 10 years, political party differences had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. Adams closed his speech by recognizing that he was a minority president. No candidate had received a majority of electoral votes. So the House of Representatives had to make the decision. The House chose Adams as the next president. He told the crowd gathered at the Capitol that he needed the help of everyone in the years to come. Presidents-elect used to give their inaugural address before their swearing in. So after his speech, John Quincy Adams took the oath of office that made him the 6th President of the United States. His father was John Adams, the 2nd President. John Quincy's mother, Abigail, made sure he received an excellent education. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. Quincy, incidentally, is how the family pronounced it. The historian tells this story about Abigail Adams and her son in 1775 in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
When her firstborn son, John Quincy, was seven, they heard the cannon fire in the distance. They went up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse and could look across Boston Harbor and see the Battle of Bunker Hill. And she took her boy by the hand. They went back down to the house, and she started melting down the family pewter with John Quincy helping her and making musket balls for the American Revolutionary troops.
Abigail and John Adams were strong patriots. They were one of the founding families of America. Harlow Giles Unger says Abigail Adams raised John Quincy to serve his country.
She told her son that if you do not grow up to be a great leader of this country, it will be because of your own laziness and obstinacy. She and her husband, John Adams, at that point decided to raise their son to be the President of the United States.
As a boy, John Quincy Adams learned to speak at least 4 languages and read Greek and Latin. He studied Shakespeare's plays. He traveled in Europe. He worked with his father in American consulates and embassies. He graduated from Harvard and was working as a lawyer by the age of 23.
He was a brilliant, brilliant young boy and man.
For about 25 years, Adams held mostly appointed jobs. He was ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States. And he served 8 years as Secretary of State. Adams spent most of his career working in public service. Harlow Giles Unger says he could be impatient, especially with lawmakers.
He despised most of the politicians he met in Congress because he found them to be ignorant and self-serving, with no sense of patriotism and sense of obligation to the nation.
John Quincy Adams did not care for political battles. When he became president, he tried to bring his political opponents and the different parts of the country together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve. And although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas about the national government. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited only to making laws to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. Many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed that these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected Adams' proposals. Harlow Giles Unger says some of the disagreements during Adams' presidency helped start the American Civil War more than 30 years later in 1861.
The country was now splitting. The South, most of the South, had never accepted the Constitution as such. The Constitution did away with state sovereignty, but many Americans never accepted that, and especially in the South.
The political picture in the United States began to change during the administration of John Quincy Adams. His opponents won control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1826. Adams' opponents called themselves Democrats. They supported Andrew Jackson and wanted him to win the next presidential election. Democrats needed the support of both the West and the South to elect Jackson. So they proposed a bill that appeared to help the West. The bill involved import taxes. A number of Western states wanted duties on industrial goods imported from other countries. The purpose was to protect their own industries. Southern states, however, opposed the import duties. They produced no industrial goods that needed protection. They argued that the Constitution did not give the government in Washington the right to approve such taxes. The Democrats expected Congress to defeat the bill they proposed. They thought the West would be grateful that the Democrats had tried to help them, and the South would be happy that there would be no import taxes. But to the Democrats' surprise, many congressmen from the Northeast joined with lawmakers from the West to support the bill. They did so even though the bill would harm industries in the Northeast. The Northerners wanted to keep the idea of protective trade taxes alive. The bill passed in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. This left President Adams with a difficult decision. Should he sign it into law, or should he veto it? If he signed the bill, it would show he believed that the Constitution allowed protective duties. That decision would create even more opposition to him in the South. If he vetoed it, then he would lose support in the West and Northeast. Adams signed the bill, but he made clear that Congress was fully responsible for it. Democrats in Congress made other attempts to weaken support for Adams. For example, they claimed that he was misusing government money. They tried to show that he and his father before him had become rich from government service. Others accused him of giving government jobs to his supporters. This charge was false. Top administration officials had urged Adams to give government jobs only to men who were loyal to him. But Adams had refused. He felt that as long as someone had done nothing wrong, he should continue in his job. During his 4 years as president, Adams removed 12 people from government jobs. In each case, the person had failed to do his work or had done something criminal. Adams often gave jobs to people who did not support him politically. He believed it was wrong to give a person a job just for political reasons. Many of Adams' supporters could not understand. They had worked hard to get him elected. Their support for him cooled. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many had for him.
His presidency was a complete failure. He was able to accomplish nothing.
The political battle between Adams' Republican Party and Jackson's Democrats remained bitter. Perhaps the worst fighting took place in the press. Each side had its own newspaper for support. The Daily National Journal supported the administration. The United States Telegraph supported Andrew Jackson. At first, the pro-administration newspaper called for national unity and an end to personal attacks. Then things changed. The paper had to defend against charges of political wrongdoing within Adams' party. It needed to turn readers away from these problems. So it printed a pamphlet that had been used against Andrew Jackson during an election campaign. The pamphlet accused Jackson of many bad things. The most damaging part involved the wife of another man. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.